It's Thursday, September 20th, 2012. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Yesterday, we reported on the sensationalism that was attached to the news that Karen King, a professor of divinity at Harvard Divinity School, had identified an ancient papyrus fragment as what she called the Gospel of Jesus' wife. At my website today at albertmoeller.com, I posted a major review of the issue, an article entitled, The Gospel of Jesus' Wife, When Sensationalism Masquerades as Scholarship. One of the first things to note is the sensationalism. For instance, Smithsonian Magazine, the official magazine of the Smithsonian Institution, no less, declared that King's announcement was, quote, apt to send jolts to the world of biblical scholarship and beyond, end quote. Later, that very same magazine said, quote, the announcement at an academic conference in Rome is sure to send shockwaves through the Christian world, end quote. Well, not hardly. But this does tell us a great deal about how the media sees an announcement such as this tiny little fragment. Remember, we're talking about an ancient fragment, which, if authentic, dates back to the 4th century, that includes 32 words and 8 broken lines. One of those lines does refer to Jesus saying, my wife. Another line refers to Mary, and what we have is now Professor King putting together an argument that this should destabilize and cast into doubt our entire understanding of early Christianity. A couple other things about Professor King. She's been involved in the so-called Gnostic Gospels for the better part of the last 2 decades. Ever since she's been at the Harvard Divinity School, she has been especially known for arguing that these Gnostic texts should serve to subvert our understanding of a normative Christianity. Her agenda has been public and clear. For instance, she told Ariel Sabar of Smithsonian, quote, you're talking to someone who's trying to integrate a whole set of heretical literature into the standard history, end quote. By the way, Karen King is so opposed to the idea of a normative Christianity, what we would also call biblical or orthodox Christianity, that she doesn't even like to use the terms heresy or, for that matter, Gnostics, because she says the very use of those terms seeks to institutionalize and affirm the notion of a normative Christianity. However, as we just heard from the previous quotation, she cannot keep from using these words herself, not only when she speaks sentences, but even when she entitles her books. Writing along with Princeton's Elaine Pagel several years ago, Karen King and Pagel said this, and I quote, the traditional history of Christianity is written almost solely from the viewpoint of the side that won, which was remarkably successful in silencing or distorting other voices, destroying their writings, and suppressing any who disagreed with them as dangerous and obstinate heretics, end quote. What King and Pagels there are arguing is that what we know as biblical or normative Christianity is just representative of a political victory of more powerful church leaders against less powerful leaders of the early Christian movement. As I make clear in my article published today, what's behind this is an effort to sideline and subvert traditional Christianity, its doctrines of a supernatural Christ, of an atonement achieved by Christ through his cross and resurrection, of ourselves as sinners in need of salvation, of the bodily resurrection of Christ, of the normative sexual teachings and moral teachings of the Scriptures, the traditional doctrines and theological truths that form the very center and foundation of the Christian faith. These are precisely what the advocates of the so-called Gnostic texts want to replace and be done with. They want to replace traditional Christianity with an entirely new religion, an entirely new faith. The issue of whether or not Jesus was married is not so much integral to this question. The larger quest is their attempt to subvert the very notion of orthodoxy and to replace it with the embrace of heterodoxy. One of the very interesting arguments made by Karen King and others in this regard is that there is no real argument for the unmarried state of Jesus or his celibacy until later centuries, especially the midpoint of the 2nd century. But that's simply for the obvious reason that it didn't have to be articulated when it wasn't questioned. The clear references to the family of Christ in the New Testament, repeated in the Synoptic Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and then also in the Gospel of John, refer to his mother and to his brothers, but not to a wife. Furthermore, the entire context of the New Testament makes very clear that Jesus did not have a wife, and that having a wife was not part of his earthly ministry. He came to have many sons and daughters through the adoption that comes by faith, but not to have sons and daughters of the flesh. Now, beyond this, of course, the Roman Catholic Church has an argument for priestly celibacy. We'll let them make that argument. But it is important for evangelicals to note at this point that our argument against the necessity of, or the normativity, for that matter, of ministerial celibacy is rooted in the Scripture, with the clear references, for instance, in 1 Timothy and in Titus, to the fact that the minister is expected to be married, the husband of one wife. But beyond that, the Roman Catholic teaching of a sacerdotal ministry has the priest actually representing Christ. Therefore, the necessity they see of priestly celibacy. The problem there is not so much the celibacy. That's a minor issue. The major issue is the theological mistake of believing that the pastor is to be a priest and is to represent Jesus. We have one high priest, a fully adequate priest. His name is Jesus. And the role of the minister is to teach and preach the gospel, to shepherd the flock of God, not to represent Christ in any kind of sacerdotal or priestly manner. One final issue when it comes to this continuing controversy. This is something you're not likely to hear anywhere else. Karen King holds the Hollis Chair of Divinity in the Harvard Divinity School. It is the oldest endowed professorship in the entire country, considered the most illustrious and indeed esteemed of all the endowed professorships in the United States. The Hollis Professor of Divinity was arranged by an instrument drawn up in London on the 22nd of August in 1721. The donor was a British citizen, a wealthy English merchant by the name of Thomas Hollis. He endowed this chair at Harvard College, and he did so on these principles, and I quote, that he, that is the professor, should be a man of solid learning in divinity, of sound or orthodox principles, one well gifted to teach, of a sober and pious life, and of a grave conversation, end quote. Those requirements are clear enough. It requires that the holder of this chair would teach in accordance with Christian orthodoxy. Nevertheless, Harvard fell so early to the Unitarian heresy, and the Unitarians, after first wondering if they could find anyone sufficiently orthodox to put in this chair, eventually decided to redefine orthodoxy so that it no longer referred to historic, biblical Christian orthodoxy, but rather to the orthodoxy of the age, of the public conversation. Thomas Hollis was a Baptist who intended that his gift would undergird the teaching of Christian orthodoxy in Harvard College. The fall of that college to theological liberalism and apostasy is a parable of the trajectory of higher education in America, of the displacement of theological orthodoxy with, first, heterodoxy, and then almost pure secularity. We can only wonder what Thomas Hollis would think if he could know that roughly 300 years after he made his gift, the occupant of his chair would be a professor arguing for this tiny little fragment as the gospel of Jesus' wife. Meanwhile, speaking of secularism, secularization, and atheism, The Economist, that major British news magazine, reports on the fact that America now has an increasing number of atheists. According to the article, the past 7 years have seen a fivefold increase in people who call themselves atheists. This is now up to approximately 5% of the American population. This, according to a network of pollsters affiliated with Wynn and Gallup. The proportion of Americans who say they are religious, according to this same research, has fallen from 73% in 2005 to 60% in 2011. Now, here's what we should note. This kind of increasing secularization, decreasing belief in God, and an increased willingness to identify as an unbeliever, this is not all that surprising. What is surprising, and this is replicated, that is, repeated and affirmed in other studies as well, is the speed with which this kind of secularization is taking place in the United States. Remember that the last figure, that is, that 73% of Americans consider themselves religious, was dated to just 2005. That, as you know, is just 7 years ago. Now, just 60%. There are a couple of other interesting aspects to all of this. First of all, the 5% who are now identifying as atheists, well, that is roughly the same number of persons who just in previous years had indicated they were some form of unbeliever. So, one reading of this data would be that what we see is that increased numbers of Americans who had been unbelievers, characterized in some way, agnostic or in some other term, now are willing to use the harder term, the more radical term of atheist. Some of this increased willingness to use the word atheist might be due to the so-called New Atheists, the movement associated with figures such as Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Christopher Hitchens, and Sam Harris. The New Atheists are new in several respects, but most importantly, because of their very clear assertion of atheism in the public square, and the use of intellectual intimidation and the authority of modern science to try to press their case. Richard Dawkins, the Oxford scientist who is one of the major proponents of the New Atheism, spoke at a so-called Reason rally held earlier this year. It was expected to draw many thousands. It disappointed its organizers and drew only a few thousand. But at that meeting, Richard Dawkins said this, quote, "We are approaching a tipping point where the number of people who have come out becomes so great that suddenly everyone will realize I can come out too," end quote. It is interesting, is it not, that the language here of atheists is that of coming out of the closet, similar to the kind of testimony given by those who came out of the closet as homosexuals. It's also interesting to note that this same research indicates that 40% of Americans said that they would not vote for an atheist political candidate. One reason why, according to several of the secularists, so many politicians and other national leaders stay in the closet, so to speak. Meanwhile, also on the subject of the New Atheists, a major conference is being held to consider whether the New Atheism is really all that new. Lois Lee reports in the British newspaper The Guardian that the new in the New Atheism is something that is puzzling many Europeans. The new appears to be particularly in the context of the United States. The secularization of Europe has gone so far that atheism is no longer in any sense shocking there. Not only is that true amongst the European elites, but increasingly amongst common, everyday Europeans as well. In Great Britain, similarly following the trajectory of Europe, atheism is no longer shocking, even amongst the elites and, for that matter, even amongst some of the Anglican bishops, as several have noted. But what we're looking at in terms of the New Atheism in the United States is a newly assertive atheism that is catching the attention of people elsewhere in the world as well. In her article in The Guardian, Lois Lee, a sociologist, comes to the conclusion from a European perspective that there really is something new about the New Atheism, with these authors, especially Dawkins, Dennett, Hitchens, and Harris, gathered together in the sense that they want to establish atheism as an intellectual momentum that, given their best-selling books and cultural influence, would be very hard to slow down, much less to stop. From a Christian perspective, one interesting note in all of this is the desperation with which the New Atheists appear to be making their arguments. They are so concerned, exasperated, surprised, and perplexed by the fact that the vast majority of Americans, unlike Europeans, continue to express belief in God. They seem to have taken on a sense of frenetic mission to try to convince Americans that it should be intellectually disrespectable and disreputable to believe in God. You put that together with the recent survey in The Economist, and it indicates that at least some are hearing their argument, but that some, at least at this point, those willing to identify themselves as atheists explicitly amounts to about 5% of the American population. 95%, thus, do not identify themselves as atheists. That's an almost inverse ratio to what has taken place, at least in much of Europe. Finally, in a report from the September 7th edition of The Week, a woman in northern Maine has given birth to her own grandson. This was possible because she acted as a surrogate mother for her daughter. The woman agreed to bear the child after learning that her daughter had a heart condition that prevented her from undergoing labor. So, in this case, the grandmother bore the grandson. The 49-year-old mother of four played down her role at her grandson's birth, saying, quote, "I just saw it as if I were babysitting for a few months," end quote. Just write that down as one more anecdote and milestone along the way of documenting our brave new world. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/AlbertMohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to spts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.